Antigone, written by the Athenian poet Sophocles in the 5th century BC, poses a dilemma. What do we do when the government says one thing, but God, or in this case the gods, say otherwise? This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast. In the play, Antigone's two brothers, Eteocles and Polynices, choose opposite sides in the civil war at Thebes. In the battle, the two brothers kill each other, just as the side Eteocles chose wins the war. The victorious new ruler, Creon, decrees that Eteocles will be honored as a great hero and buried with all dignity and holy rites. As for Polynices, Creon says, "It has been proclaimed to the city that no one honor with a tomb or lament with cries, but let him lie unburied, his body devoured by birds and by dogs and mangled for the seeing." Disobedience to Creon will be punishable by death. But the gods decree the dead should be buried. That one I shall give rites, says Antigone. It is noble for me to die doing this. Dr. Virginia Arbery taught a class on Antigone and her courage at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Here are Dr. Arbery's comments.
We have quite a few dead people piling up already and corpses. We've thought about Patroclus's body and how it's revived. We've thought about Hector's and how it becomes the central point of a new kind of beginning beyond the heroic age, with the promptings of the gods to Achilles to reconcile himself to Priam. And now today we see a young girl who commits suicide, a young boy who commits suicide, and a mother who grieves the loss of both her children, both her sons. And yet we also see what I will call a figure who, like Achilles, gives us something new and irreplaceable in the world, a sense of our mortality in a way that the poem shows us is possibly a way to sustain the immortal, eternal order. While Antigone, a frail girl about the age of our freshmen, is a figure who is a pillar who holds up, it seems to me, the whole Western tradition of law. She is a girl, as you know, from the chorus, and they're, I would call them pusillanimous. They're afraid to take the role of guarding the body, right? They get somebody younger, Creon, right? But they're afraid to object to him, which is another sign of a tyrannical undertone to his new rule. He just became ruler the very morning that the play begins. We see the advice of others, such as the sister of Antigone, to yield to evils, just yield to evils. And Creon tells her, you'll remember, "Aren't you ashamed to think apart from these men, the old men of the chorus? Can you be, in fact, a philos, a friend, friend of a family, the friend among your own, the closeness that philos means? Aren't you afraid, Creon says, aren't you ashamed not to think the way all these others do? Why do you have to be different? How can you be a philo, a friend to the city, and affirm the rights of honor to an enemy, your brother?" So this play, this first play that you're looking at today, among the tragedies of Sophocles, is the one that won him one of his 24 prizes, and it's said to be, as the second great tragedian after Aeschylus, this play is said to be Sophocles' ticket to his military career as well. This is a man that spans a long period, from the period at the end of the aftermath of the Persian War all the way to the end of the Peloponnesian War. He lives until he's about 90. I like these old figures more and more. As my husband says, we used to identify ourselves with Achilles and the girls, the Iliad I did, huh? The girls, the war pride, right? And now he identifies himself with Nestor, the old wise one, and identify myself with the old wife of Nestor. So you get this sense in Sophocles' life of someone who saw relationships between the old stories. This is an old story, the story of Oedipus, right? And you know it, right? Although I did have a colleague one time, I'm embarrassed to say, maybe he was from Down Under, he was from Australia, and he said, "Mates, you're making me teach this play. I can't believe it. He kills his father and sleeps with his mother." This man was 30 years old. He never read it before. He was great in political philosophy, but he had zero knowledge of the great literary tradition. But I said, "Haven't you ever heard of the Oedipal complex?" You know? "No, never thought about that. We don't do those things in Australia." Yeah, well, anyway, so you know that story. So the play about Oedipus is actually written after this play. This was his first big hit in 441 BC. He writes it about 50 years after the defeat of Persia by tiny little Greek city-states, mainly the camaraderie at that time of Sparta and Athens, two cities bound together by their commitment against a common enemy, their friends at that point, but not long after, they are in civil war, brother against brother, and that is the great Peloponnesian War. So Sophocles' work is deeply immersed imaginatively in the, we would call it the belligerent outer enemies of Athens and the belligerent inner enemies of Athens. Athens itself is always torn apart by faction, by this war between brothers. So the emphasis of the translator Green on Philos, friend of a family and so on, I think is very useful. We see, of course, in the Iliad how it's over a friend, one who he is loved more than his own life, Achilles says, over a friend, that he re-enters the battle and commits himself to everlasting glory through accepting his fate. So Philos, in its opposite meaning, seems very close almost to its positive meaning. I don't know about you, we probably all have very nice antiseptic family backgrounds. I don't see any Italians in the room. Good for you. I thought you were Polish.
Half-time.
Oh. Well, I see. Well, in a Sicilian family, you know, those you love the most are also the ones you hate the most, right? And you see the complex problem of Oedipus's family, because not only are they related, but they're doubly, triply related. Her father is her brother, right? The same womb, that uterine home, as the translator puts it, gives issue to her brothers, right? So the two girls, you may not know this, of course it's the last play he writes, way out of sequence. Oedipus at Colonus, which, by the way, is Sophocles' hometown. Colonus is the play in which we see the two brothers about to go at war, and Polynices coming to his father, Oedipus, asking him for help. Because Oedipus, who is the outcast, the polluted one, because he has killed his father and slept with his mother, unbeknownst to himself when he does these things. But in any case, the son, Polynices, comes to him and says, "Bless me, help me against your wicked son, the younger brother, Eteocles, who's trying to be the permanent ruler of your city, Thebes." And the father curses him. It's the best curse I've ever read anywhere in literature. I would repeat it, except it's really quite, it's extraordinary. But he says, "You know, you come to me now when you need me, but you cast me out when I needed you, and your two frail sisters took care of me where I had no hearth to go to. Damn you, curse you." etc., you will die at your brother's hand, and he will die at yours. So he predicts it all. And Antigone pleads with her father not to make the curse, you know, to keep some peace in the family. Though he loves Antigone, she's the faithful one who, as she says in this play that you read, washes all the bodies, prepares them for burial, every one of them, her mother, her father, her life has been spent in serving that passageway from life to death. Antigone is not listened to by her father. So this is the play, which has a kind of prominence throughout not only Greek history but into contemporary history, what this girl does. In his own day, just 60 years after the play, Demosthenes, the great orator, will quote whole passages of Creon's speech to Ascanes, who actually played in the play on stage, to remember what your loyalty to the city should be. So let's look at that passage and then look at another. As our teachers, Don and Louise Cowan, used to say in thinking about this play, he was president of the University of Dallas, and he'd say, this man is a middle manager who should have stayed at the lower administrative level, right? And all of a sudden, he's president, and he has to make, he's, you know, ruler, and he has to make all these decisions, which he'd rather not do. So he's worried about his bella figura. Is he going to pull it off, right? Ruling shows the man, as Bias, the one of the seven sages of Greece, says. So 175. Now, there is no way to learn thoroughly the essence of the whole man, as well as his thought and judgment, until he has been seen engaged in ruling and making laws. For in my opinion, whoever in guiding a whole city does not adhere to the best counsels, but from fear of something keeps his tongue locked, that man seems to me now and before this to be most evil. Whoever deems a Philos more important than his fatherland, this man, I say, is nowhere. I, for one, may Zeus, who always sees all, know this, never would I keep silent on seeing ruin approaching the citizens instead of safety. Neither would I ever regard as my Philos the enemy of the land, since I am aware that this land is the one who carries us safely. He gives us the metaphor here of the ship of state. And while sailing upon her upright, he loves this word orthos, right. He's right. He's always right. We make our philoi. We are philoi through the state, not through any other bonds. By these laws, I do enlarge the city. So that's one point of view. Aristotle, at least five times in his rhetoric, only 100 years after this play, will use Creon is the example of particular law at odds with what he begins to call, giving us the seed of the natural law tradition, universal law, which is spoken by Antigone. In these famous lines, which Aristotle quotes himself in the Rhetoric. Yes, Zeus was not the one who issued these proclamations for me, nor did justice, who dwells with the gods below, defines such laws among mankind. I did not think your proclamation so strong that you, immortal, could overstep God's unwritten and unshakable traditions. Not today or yesterday, but always they live, and no one knows when they appeared. I was not about to pay the penalty before gods for neglecting them out of fear for a man's thought. So you see the juxtaposition that Aristotle thinks is consequential. So from the poet, from the tragedian, he gains a great philosophic root for this contest, this war, as it were, between positive law, or the particular law that Creon is asserting as the basis for all friendship, and universal law as a higher one to which all of those in friendship must look in order to preserve right relationship. This play also is extremely influential with Pericles, who actually is a fellow general with Sophocles as they take over the revolting colony of Samos. But anyway, Pericles' funeral oration, if you look at it, will say basically the same thing as Creon says. He'll say in his great funeral oration, don't worry about your son being dead, or your husband, or your brother. Oh, you can marry again, get another son. If you're young enough, you can get another husband. What you should care about is your eros. He uses the word eros for Athens. Athens is everything, right? So none of these pre-political or familial relationships take precedence over the city. Flip forward, if you will, to Hegel, mid-19th century. If you know Hegel, I only read him when I've had a lot of bourbon. But Hegel loves Creon, right? He makes the point, you know, this is the man who gives us the image of the unified state, right? What would we do without Sophocles? Thank you for the figure of Creon, not Antigone, right? Because Creon shows us that if you have two contesting powers, both of which claim eminent authority, one the state, the other religious belief, or what you could also say, though it's a little bit different, universal law here, one of them has to give way, and for the sake of the preeminence of safety, the unity of the state, the glory of the state, depends on the preeminence of positive law. Okay, another 100 years go by, and we're a few months before Normandy. A play is written by Jean Henri, in which the figure of Antigone becomes absolutely identified with the resistance. The corpses of the resistance movement are being put on the street, left exposed by the Nazis. Henri writes this play, rewrites the play light-handedly. So he rewrites the play in order to point to the glory of this girl. But of course, the Germans are there watching it at the same time in 1944, and they see it completely differently. They see it from the standpoint of Creon. Right? Then 4 years later in 1948, Bertolt Brecht, whose plays I hate, but I kind of like this one, gives us an amazing rendition of the play as a homage to Antigone and as a rebuke to the Germans who did not resist their tyrannical leader. So it's a lament. So you see the virility of this play, its durability, its power, despite the controversy and the way in which the interpretation's different. The point of view toward the play, the different perspectives toward the action, you know, are infinitely subject to interpretation. Part of the point of view, of course, comes from the necessity for peace, right? Creon wants to ensure that this civil war doesn't happen again. Now, there's no other brother contending for rule here in the city, and you have a bunch of cowed old men, right? You had 7 kings come against Thebes just the day before. 7 kings against 7 gates. There's 7 gates in the city. There'll be a play about this later, 7 against Thebes. You have all of the tension that fueled the contest over. You only have 2 weak girls left in the family and a reluctant uncle who's trying to show his power, right? And you have the point of view of Creon, who wants to show that he's a man. What, how does he say this so many times? Feminists have a lot of fun with this play. He says, "No woman will rule me." Right. A little bit earlier, he'll say that, you know, basically, I'm the man. After she acted this second outrage, she boasts about them and exults in having done them. In this case, I am not a man, but she is a man. Now, this is more than just saying, I'm a man and she's a woman, or I'm a male and she's a female. This means a lot more in the Greek, because the word for man, aner, they have a different word for human beings, which is anthropois, but aner, which is man, is the root word for courage, Andrea. So if you say, I'm a man, you say, I have courage, right? And how can a woman have that very quality which is woven into my manliness, right? So if you take his point of view, to concede to her is to concede to being neutered. Right? You're nothing. You're not the man. So he'll tell Haman, if when his sensible son, who we learn from Ismene, is engaged to his cousin Antigone, his reaction to Haman is pretty exuberant. Right? He says, while I am alive, no woman will rule me. Spit the girl out like an enemy. Let someone in Hades' house marry her. This is interesting, isn't it? The realm of the dead to which you go after you're buried, the burial now, the burial rites are being associated with marriage rites. This is another terrible juxtaposition in the play. You don't want to think about burial rites next to marriage rites. They just don't go together. Right? But in this play, we're asked to think about that, as in fact Antigone goes into the cave. She goes into that cave to her bridegroom Hades' death, partly because, you know why? Creon is a coward and doesn't want to stone her anymore, which is a public act of execution. Everybody picks up a stone, kills them, right? But he changes his mind when she says to Haman, here, I'm going to kill her right in front of you. But he changes his mind. He weakens and decides to put her in the cave, and then and it's basically like Pontius Pilate. I'll wash my hands of it. I'll give her a little food, but she'll starve to death. But I didn't do it. Right? So there's a lack of courage there for someone who calls himself the man. In any case, he can't listen to Haman's argument. And Haman, Aristotle will quote him as well in the rhetoric. He gives the argument for keeping her alive. He calls her the crown of gold that the city loves, as if it's the argument of the city, not his own argument, right? Which is a smart thing to do sometimes if you're not going to be listened to by someone who's your superior. You say the argument is this body, right? This great body of the city. But that falls on dead ears as well, because what does Creon say? I'm the city. The people are not the city. I'm the city. And you'll recall how Haman responds, right, if you want to be king of a desert island, or if you want to be king of an empty place where there are no people. All right, so that's one contest. There are several warlike combats of verbal back and forth debates in the play. But another, and an earlier one, of course, is between the two sisters. I happen to think that Antigone is right in the harsh way she treats her sister. You may find it repulsive to be that hard on your sister, but you might want to decide what you think. Let's look at the dialogue. So this is Ismene's point of view towards the proclamation by their uncle. Now in turn, we two left all alone. Consider how badly we will perish if in violence of the law we transgress the decree and power of the absolute rulers. Now we two women must keep in mind we were born women whose purpose is not to battle against men. Then, because we are ruled by those who are stronger, we must hear and obey this and things yet more painful. As for me, begging those below for pardon, since I am being forced in this, I will yield to those in authority, for acting in excess has no sense. So when you think about that admonition, don't act in excess, what does that say about the possibility of courage in someone like Antigone, who's both a woman and under a decree of sentence to death if she should bury the brother who's the traitor and give him the proper funeral rites in the same way that the brother who isn't the traitor had? What do we say about excess? That excess makes no sense. Now, you'll remember, if you read the Aristotle already, how important spiritedness is to the virtue of courage. And without some excess of spiritedness, it's very hard to be able to face death, to be fearless in the face of death. Ismene says, I am doing them no dishonor, but I am incapable by my nature of acting in violence of the citizens. And Antigone says, "You can make excuses, but I shall go heap up a mound for a most Philo's brother." Right. "Ah me, unhappy me," and Ismene then says, "Keep it a secret. If we do it secretly, I will do it with you." And this just makes Antigone even more adamant. "Tell everybody! You will be more hostile if you keep silent and do not proclaim this to everyone." And the sister says, "You have a hot heart for cold things." "No, I know I am pleasing those I should most please. If you can, but no, you lust for what is beyond your means. Well, when my strength fails, I shall cease once for all. From the outset, to hunt for what is beyond your means is not fitting." When you are courageous as this girl, I mean, is any of us going to say this girl is not courageous? Is it possible to be courageous and also to do the mean, what one should do? The courageous is considered the midpoint between foolhardiness, Aristotle will say, where you just go ballistic, have inordinate bravado, and weakness. Weakness that is reproachable. So what does it mean to go beyond your means? Does that mean your place? Right? Where you are in the civic order? If so, there's no possibility, is there, in human history for a resistance, right? Or a martyr, perpetual infelicity. If so, if you don't, if you think, in fact, that you shouldn't go beyond your means, that it's excessive to do so, then I don't know what would happen to the noble, the truly beautiful. Look at what Antigone says in response. "If you say this, you will be hated by me and justly be deemed an enemy to the one dead. No, let me and the foolish counsel I offer suffer something dreadful, but I shall not suffer anything that will keep me from dying nobly." Another point of discussion. Aristotle says in the Ethics, you know, living itself is not an end. There's something higher than living, and that is acting beautifully. Now, it's translated nobly, but the word is kalon, and kalon, the root word of kalon is to call. So at root in the word beautiful, often translated as fine and noble, is being called to something beyond one's own middleness, one's own situation. It's called to something. It's a evocation to act in a way. And so she'll say that she buried her brother as she's about to die because she wanted to do something beautiful.
The Acts of the Apostles, chapter 5. Verses 27 to 29. "And when they had brought them, they set them before the council. And the high priest questioned them, saying, 'We strictly charged you not to teach in this name. Yet here you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching, and you intend to bring this man's blood upon us.' But Peter and the apostles answered, 'We must obey God rather than men.'" Like Antigone, St. Peter and the apostles faced the choice between unjust laws and faithful obedience. It's a choice that Christians across the globe face even today. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.